We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with you at the State. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover, starting with local and Mr. Shandy Cobain.
Yes, police, Seattle Police Detective Shandy Cobain was suspended for 30 days without pay this week instead of being fired by Police Chief Diaz for uttering a racial slur to a suspect in a robbery last year. And in fact, the suspect was not even arrested for that robbery. He was detained and then released.
Turned out to be the wrong guy.
Turned out to be the wrong guy. That's right. And a number of groups had called for Police Chief Diaz to fire Cobain, saying that this was absolutely unacceptable that Cobain stomped on the guy, uttered the racial slur, et cetera.
And Cobain has a history, too. And, it's not like this is like an isolated incident.
Yeah, Cobain. You
know, anybody can have a bad day, but he's had a bad decade.
Yeah, Cobain is a detective with a gang unit. And Diaz said, well, you know, I couldn't fire him because of the legal repercussions, because, you know, we've never fired anybody before for uttering a racial slur. We've only just suspended them, which, of course, is a big part of the problem. I mean,
thank you.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't have pointed out the problem better than by just looking at that comment that this is the reason.
Well, we can't discipline them because we've always given people medals for uttering racial slurs before.
Yes. So.
So we have to give him a medal too. So,
but in this case, Cobain, they busted him down to a patrol officer, so he's not a detective with a gang unit anymore, and he's being suspended 30 days without pay, but he still gets to keep his job. And Diaz did say that next time, though, an officer was caught on tape uttering a racial slur, that person would lose their job. Still, that's cold comfort.
Wait a minute. Mm-hmm. So somebody who has a long history of misconduct and brutality and being involved in inappropriate, you know, being involved in things for which he's drawn the public's attention in the past, so he can do something like this, and we're not going to fire him, but we'll fire whoever the next random schmo is that comes along.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
So they can't fire him because of precedent, but in the future they can fire somebody regardless of the precedent.
Right. Right. Because now Diaz has issued that warning, saying that, oh, look out, you guys. You know, now you're being put on. Yeah.
Because before, nobody in the police department would have known that it was a bad thing.
Assuming that Diaz is still the chief of police at the.
Exactly, exactly. And the Department of Justice's investigation into the Seattle Police Department is ongoing. In fact, this week, and they did a number of public meetings with folks who have alleged police misconduct and taken testimony. So, you know, I mean,
And Mike's is a fair point. I mean, Diaz might not be the police chief next time, and you might get somebody who's not quite so strict with officer misconduct.
Right, right. That's always a possibility.
All right, let's move on. Bicycle guy.
Bicycle guy. Yeah, Mayor McGinn filled a vacancy at City Hall this week when he hired his new transportation advisor, David Hiller, who's the former advocacy director for Cascade Bicycle Club. Of course, this set off the media immediately, the mainstream media, the Seattle Times and representatives of the local TV news stations were busy bothering Mayor McGinn trying to get a quote on why he would dare to hire Bicycle Guy as his transportation director. But I tell you, yesterday I was standing downtown at 8 a.m. in the morning waiting for a bus because I use the buses a lot. And I was standing on 3rd Avenue and I was counting the number of bicyclists going by. It's an enormous number of people who commute by bicycle in this city on a street where they have to share, where there are no bicycle lanes, where they have to share the street with a huge number of buses, which can be very intimidating.
Maria, it is not a huge number. It's approximately 2% of all commuters. It's about 6,000 to 8,000 people a day. That's not a large number.
I think it's a lot more than that since gas prices have gone up, Jav.
A lot more, what, 10% more, 20% more? You could triple it, and it's still not a significant number.
It's a lot of people. For a city that is not very bicycle-friendly, it's a lot of people.
I understand that, and I understand that it's a significant number. I don't think it's a lot of number compared to the overall number of commuters in Seattle. But the problem that I have with it, and this is a rare incidence where, quite frankly, I think the Seattle Times and the mainstream TV stations are correct, is that, you know, there are a lot of people who cannot bicycle as a means of commuting, and somebody whose only transportation expertise is in bicycling cannot service the other modes of transportation. You need a mixture of a lot of different ways to bicycle, and I'm getting really, really tired of Mayor McGinn's fanaticism on this issue. He hates cars, and he thinks bicycles are for everybody. And they're not. They're not for the disabled. They're not for the elderly. They're not with people with three kids and five bags of groceries. You know, there's just all, there, is it desirable to get more people out of their cars? Absolutely. Is it desirable to get more people on bicycles? Yes. But it's never going, particularly in this climate and this topography, it's never going to be the way that a lot of people you know, do anything more than recreationally bicycle. And
I disagree.
I disagree. You're entitled to, but the numbers don't back you up, Maria.
I disagree. What I want, what
I'm taking the city's own numbers.
I know. What I wanna say in answer to that is that for perhaps the past century, the transportation advisor and folks in charge of transportation planning in this state and in this city, in fact, in this whole country, have been folks who believe that the only means of transportation or the best means of transportation is by personal automobile. I think it's time we had a switch. I really do. And I don't see how someone like David Hiller couldn't service all the transportation needs of the city just because his expertise is in bicycling.
Well, because the Cascade Bicycle Club is not simply something where expertise is in bicycles. They are advocates for bicycles.
Yes, yes.
And that's what he's been paid to do, is advocate for bicycles. Yes. And, you know, it's like hiring somebody from AAA to be your transportation advisor. I'd object to that too.
All right, we got other things to cover.
But yeah. I mean, most of the time, you know, other mayors have appointed people for transportation whose expertise is only for road construction.
I understand that, and I don't support that either.
Yeah.
All right.
And
let's move on. Hello. Up next, Mayor McGinn and Mr. Councilmember O'Brien and Licata.
Yeah, they issued a proposal this week to devote the old fire station number 39 at Northeast 127th Street in Lake City to be used as a homeless shelter. This is at the same time that Nicholsville, which has been using that site, decided to pack up and move from that site to their old home down on, is it East Marginal Way South? Is where they're at now.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they moved for a couple of reasons. Richard Conlon had offered that they could stay there at the old firehouse, but the problem is that the site is simply not big enough for all of the people who utilize the Nicholsville Tent City. In addition, taking a big building...
It also has no privacy.
Yeah, taking a big building like that and trying to stuff a large number of people inside it when there, as Job said, no privacy... there are a lot of families that live in Nicholsville. There are a lot of couples, and most shelters don't allow any kind of room for families to stay together or for couples to stay together. And so the folks at Nicholsville are saying, look, you know, we're a tent city, literally. We're a community, and we need a solution that's going to address the whole community. In the meantime, though, if this proposal goes forward to create a homeless shelter at the old firehouse, that might be good news for folks who have been complaining that shelter space in Seattle is literally not up to the demand.
All right. One of the tunnel initiatives yesterday had its day in court.
Yeah, King County Superior Court Judge Laura Middaugh issued two rulings in the case that was brought by City Attorney Pete Holmes and City Council President Richard Conlon against one of the tunnel initiatives. She first said that the City Council President and the City Attorney don't have the authority to file a suit against the citizens' referendum on the tunnel. So, of course, at the last minute, the State Department of Transportation decided to take the lead on the suit. So Middaugh said, okay, sure, the suit can go ahead as long as the state sues the citizens of the city of Seattle and not the city's own attorney and council president. Her second ruling is that most of the council votes at issue in the referendum were actually administrative and not legislative, except for one vote taken on the agreements between the city and state regarding the utilities, right-of-way, and insurance for the tunnel. She said the council, when they took that vote, they added language saying that they that the council would take a later public vote to officially start construction on the tunnel, and that by adding that language, they made that that agreement a policy decision and not a merely administrative decision, so that the referendum can go forward as long as the language of the referendum is changed. So next Friday, the lawyers for Protect Seattle Now and the Sierra Club, who are defending the citizens' referendum in court, will have to meet with the judge to figure out what kind of wording is going to be acceptable for the referendum. That doesn't leave a whole lot of time, because the deadline for putting the referendum on the ballot is May 24th.
No, let's be clear about this. The deadline is May 24th for putting it on the ballot in August, which is what the city wants to do.
Yes.
Because there's a much lower turnout in the summer, mm-hmm. and the city thinks it will be to its advantage. That is to say, the anti-tunnel forces will have less of a chance of winning if the ballot is on, if the measure is on the ballot in August.
And so the effect of this lawsuit has been to delay, and in the hopes that backers of the referendum will give up if it doesn't make the May 24th deadline. But I don't think they will. And if it gets on the November ballot, I think it would be a lot better for the referendum.
Yeah, it'd be a lot better for the referendum. The city is aware of that also. The other thing that's interesting about that is that the city and state lawyers have both said that they intend to continue appealing this if MIDAW's ruling goes against them. That's number one. Secondly, it's very interesting that MIDAW's husband could actually have a pretty significant role in this, particularly around the controversy of whether the state legislature intends for cost overruns to be paid by the city or state, which, of course, is one of the main arguments of Mayor McGinn and of a lot of the tunnel opponents, because MIDAW's husband is State Senator Adam Klein.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm kind of surprised that she didn't recuse herself from the case. But, yeah, whatever. It's a small town.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Moving on. The protest this week at the University of Washington.
Yeah, 27 students were arrested at the University of Washington on Wednesday when they entered Gerberding Hall to do a sit-in in the interim president's office. Why were they doing this? Because the University of Washington has a contract with Sodexo, a multinational corporation, to provide concessions at UW sporting events. Sodexo was the target of a report issued, well, two reports, one issued by Human Rights Watch and one issued by Trans Africa Forum, saying that Sodexo engages in violations of wage and labor laws in other nations, and that it uses intimidation against union organizers. Sodexo has operations in 80 countries around the world. These University of Washington students had gotten together and petitioned the university administration, most particularly the president and the Board of Regents, to end the contract with Sodexo. The contract is in its final year of a 5-year contract, and it's a good time right now to terminate the contract, because there would be some months for the University of Washington to find a new company to do concessions at sporting events in the fall. However, the president and the Board of Regents have totally blown off students' concerns, even though these students were representing an ASUW resolution that was passed in support of terminating the contract, and numerous professors have written letters of support to terminate the contract. So on Thursday, even though those 27 students were arrested, the president refused to meet with them. On Thursday, students again entered Gerberding Hall, this time to address the Board of Regents. Hopefully, the Board of Regents will be listening. We'll see.
Students, professors, they're disposable.
This comes at the same time that the legislature, the state legislature this week, granted Washington State University administrators the right to raise tuition rates as much as they want for the next 4 years. This comes on top of 2 years of double-digit increases in tuition at most state universities. And it set off a mini storm of protest at the UW in particular, because there's the perception that students are being asked to pay while profile upper level administrators and professors, some of whom tenured professors, some of whom make more money per year than the governor of the state of Washington. In fact, at the UW, I think it's over 100 upper level administrators who make more than the governor of the state of Washington. They're not being asked to take cuts, and yet students are being asked to pay increasingly large amounts in tuition in order to keep to support those guys.
Well,
keep
look,
things
the University
going.
Of Washington is a big corporation. Students are
that's
not what
exactly what it's turning into.
That students are not what they're there for. Oh wait.
All right.
Let's move on.
Speaking of governor and what she makes, she signed a bill this week.
Yeah, bill say goodbye to the presidential primary in 2012. The state of Washington has agreed as a budget-cutting measure not to hold a primary. Both parties instead will strictly base their presidential delegates to the national conventions upon caucuses. Now, of course, both of the Democrats have never used the presidential primary to actually pick their delegates, and the Republicans have only done partially so. The parties much prefer to do caucuses because that way they can get names and addresses and ask you for money afterwards for the next 4 years. But nonetheless, the primary has been very popular with a lot of voters, and so the parties have felt somewhat obligated to at least have the beauty contest. The state has decided, and remember that the legislature and the governor are all Democrats, and that's the party that hasn't used the primary at all as part of their selection process. They decided that we can dispense with the voters this time. We'd much rather have party activists deciding who the nominees are going to be.
All right.
Not that there's any suspense for on the Democratic side next year anyway.
Right.
Let's move on to national and the Internal Revenue Service.
The IRS sent letters to five big donors to 501c4 organizations warning that they may owe gift tax. For folks who don't recall, 501c4 organizations are tax-exempt corporations. They're not public charities. They're exempt from paying tax, but your contributions to them are not tax deductible.
And generally the reason that C4 is an organization.
Can I just finish?
Oh, sorry.
I just want to remind folks, 501c4s often participated in issue advertising during the last campaign cycle, primarily in support of Republican causes and Republican candidates, even though they're not supposed to participate or the majority of their activities are not supposed to be political.
That's not actually
true. Yes, that is true. Less than 50% of their activities are supposed to be can be political.
Yeah,
the majority
true.
Of their activities are supposed to be non-political. Huge donations to these organizations were made by billionaires like George Soros and David H. Koch. Mostly the 501c4 organizations came out with issue advertising in support of Republican causes.
Just to clarify, there are the vast majority of 501c4s are fairly small organizations that do between 10% and 50% of their advocacy around political issues, but there are some large ones, particularly that have sprung up in the wake of Citizens United in the last year, and those are the ones we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm. And those are those big donors, those billionaires who have donated huge amounts of money to those organizations are the ones that receive the letters. Now, gift taxes. Usually that means anyone can donate to a 501c4 organization. If you donate a couple hundred bucks, you're okay. You don't have to pay any tax on your gift taxes unless you give one individual more than $13,000 or the total number of individuals that you gift to in the year more than $13,000, in that year. But these donors, these guys donated millions of dollars to these organizations, and so the IRS is putting them on notice. Look, that's a gift that you may owe tax on, and we're coming after you. I think that's very interesting and long overdue.
All right. Moving on, the National Research Council.
Yeah. In 2009, Congress commissioned the National Academy of Sciences to study global warming and issue a report on recommended policy procedures. In other words, Congress wanted them to point a way forward in how to address global warming if it really did exist. The National Research Council was formed. The National Research Council, which is an arm of the National Academy of Sciences, is composed of scientists, business leaders, and bipartisan selection of politicians. They issued their report this week. It's called America's Climate Choices, and it had three interesting aspects to the report I just want to talk about briefly. They came out and said, yes, global warming is a fact. The evidence is overwhelming, and Americans need to accept it as fact.
And how pathetic is it that 20 years after the science has been conclusive on that, that we're still having that discussion?
We're still having that discussion, yes. Another of its conclusions was the U.S. government must act now to limit carbon emissions, that we've left it too long and action should be done immediately. And then the third aspect of the report that I want to briefly discuss is that they had high praise for a carbon tax. They said that the best way to limit carbon would be to put a price on it. And of course, that means a carbon tax. They did not, however, go that extra step and recommend that Congress institute a carbon tax, which would have been a good thing. But of course, you know, they couldn't, they actually couldn't get up the courage to do that.
Yeah. And it'd be moot anyway, because Congress will.
Would never do it.
All right. The Florida legislature.
Yeah, interesting little Tea Party note here. The Florida State Legislature this week, tackling a problem that was tackled actually a few years ago by the Washington State Legislature, made a move this past week to outlaw bestiality, sex with animals. The only problem that the state of Florida ran into was that somebody noticed that they worded it slightly wrongly. They did in fact outlaw sex with animals. All animals, including human beings. So effective October 11th, 2011, unless, of course, the Florida State Legislature goes into special session to fix this, sex with all other animals, including human beings, will be illegal in the state of Florida.
So you're saying if I travel to Florida, with a partner, I'd have to get separate hotel rooms?
Well, no, actually, there is an exemption. If you contract a professional veterinary medicine person and get an exemption on the basis of animal husbandry, then you'll be good.
All right. Moving on to international and developments with Fukushima.
Yeah, workers at Fukushima have discovered the partial meltdown of Unit 1. I think we talked about a week or two ago how workers had first entered Unit 1 to find out what the situation was there, because up to this point workers had not been able to get in there because of high levels of radioactivity. They have found finally discovered by looking at it, the actual condition of Unit 1, the reactor. The water in the reactor core is much lower than they thought. It is 16 feet below the targeted level, which is desirable to cover the 13-foot fuel rods, leaving them fully exposed. Some of the rods have melted completely away into the bottom of the containment vessel, and the low level of water, given that they've pumped 10,400 metric tons into Unit 1, assumes that there must be a very, very big leak in the containment vessel somewhere, and that could be the source or one of the sources for the highly radioactive water that has flooded the plant. However, they do know that Unit 1 is not the only one that is leaking. Units 2 and Units 3 are also leaking, but they still don't know the status of those because they haven't been able to get inside to look at them. This really complicates the plan, the company's plan and the Japanese government's plan to bring the reactors to a cold shutdown within the next 6 to 12 months. And it really points out that the status of Fukushima means that it's going to take not months, but years to stabilize the plants and clean up the mess.
All right. And Palestine.
Some happier news after that very bad news. The French press agency, AFP, reported this week that a senior Fatah party member told them that he expects Hamas and Fatah to create a new unity government within the next week, which, if it's true, would be extremely fast. And it really shows the speed and the seriousness that the two rival political factions in Palestine are taking this notion of having a unity government and doing elections within a year. And that, I think, is good news.
Yeah. And in contrast, as O's say, let's pick a random country, Iraq.
Yeah, where you can't get a unity government no matter how hard you try.
All right. A few minutes left. Events.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. There's a workshop today called A Workshop on Money. It's actually going to run two consecutive Saturdays. It's being hosted by the Fellowship of Reconciliation, Just Sustainable Economy Committee, and Keep Our Money in Washington this Saturday from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. at Keystone Congregational Church at 5019 Keystone Place North. They'll be having workshops on how money works and how the economy works. And next Saturday, they're going to be talking about banking, big banks, and maybe putting together a public bank for the state of Washington. So that's highly recommended. It is a free workshop, and I'm encouraging people to go. Also, on Sunday, from noon to 5 p.m. at Westlake Plaza, there's going to be a Nakba remembrance of the 1948 expulsion of Palestinians. It's organized by Voices of Palestine, Palestine Solidarity Committee, and the Seattle Mideast Awareness Campaign. On this coming Wednesday at the Good Shepherd Center on 4649 Sunnyside Avenue North in room 202, Washington Physicians for Social Responsibility will have a forum called Unsung Nuclear Impacts of Hanford. That is also highly recommended. And on the same night, on Wednesday from 7 to 9 p.m., Finney Neighbors for Peace will be having a forum called Attacking Public Sector Unions. That's at the Woodland Park Presbyterian Church at 225 North 70th Street.
And one more to add to that, the city, as some people may know, has an opt-out program now for Yellow Pages because, a lot of people just take them straight to their recycling bin, and you can save an awful lot of paper by just not getting them in the first place. The deadline for doing that in time to not receive the Dex Yellow Pages, which is the largest Yellow Page drop of the year in the state of, actually the state of Washington, but certainly in the city of Seattle, is this Monday, the 16th. So if you want to do that in time for the 16th, it's a long URL for the city. It's only an online program at this point, although they do want to get it so you can call in sometime soon. But we posted up on the Eat the State blog the link for it to go to, because it would be pretty hard to do it over the radio. So,
and you can actually cut off all the phone books and various other things through that link as well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So reduce your...
Reduce your paper footprint. Consumption.
Yes.
Reduce your footprint.
Your unwanted papers. All right. Talking as we do every week with Job Parrish and Maria Tomchik, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State in that link?
www.eatthestate.org. There's a blog there with this really cool link for reducing your footprint for paper consumption. You also have comics and articles and humor and, whatever we feel like throwing up that particular day. So check it out, www.eatthestate.org.
Emphasis on throwing up.
Uh-huh.